some work that Alexei Starobinsky did quite a long time ago that I think still has not been, the generality and power of it has still not been appreciated. And I'd like to give you a really careful blow-by-blow proof of why it is that it works to all orders to sum the leading infrared logarithms. And I think it's also good to begin with just taking a brief note of the fact that what we're doing is not just mathematics. It actually is driven by an important physical process, and that is that the space-time expansion ought to strengthen quantum loop effects. And we all know why this ought to be in the sort of cartoon picture. The reason is that any kind of a quantum loop effect can be understood as the classical response to virtual particles. For example, the spooky phenomenon of vacuum polarization can be understood just by saying that I'm seeing you all clearly because of all the charged particles in this glass. And when you pump an electric field through the glass, the electrons move opposite to it, and the protons move towards it, and that changes the dielectric properties of the medium. Well, same thing, of course, happens in empty space when you just have virtual particles popping in and out of the vacuum, okay? And if you just put that in, just put in the quantum input from that, and then say, okay, what's the classical response to that, which is exactly the same as in my glasses, then you can understand, I think I calculated it once, you can get within a factor of 8 of the exact one-loop result in quantum electrodynamics. So this is awesome, right? And in that context, anything that increases the number of virtual particles or the amount of time, the density of them, or the amount of time that they live is going to strengthen quantum effects, right? Sort of a no-brainer. Well, the expansion of space-time is going to do that just for the obvious reason, right? If a virtual particle pops out, it could get trapped in the Hubble flow and just pulled apart. And that, in a nutshell, is why it is that there are stronger quantum effects in an expanding universe than there are in flat space. And I'm, of course, not the first person to note this. I think it was noted way, way back by, was it Heisenberg or Schrodinger? Schrodinger, I think. And Leonard Parker, back before some of us were born, did the first analytic calculations of it. So it's been known for a long, long time. It's also known that the effect maximizes in inflation. The more rapidly you accelerate the universe, the bigger the effect is. Inflation is as rapid as you can, or de Sitter is as rapid as you can accelerate the universe consistent with classical stability. And just like in flat space, of course, the biggest effects come from lowest particles. Because why? Because they last the longest, according to the energy-time uncertainty principle. And then also, of course, you have to be able to feel the expansion of space-time, so you're not going to get the biggest effect from particles which are classically conformally invariant, although they will contribute something due to the conformal anomaly. These two requirements right here rule out almost everything that we know. At the scales of primordial inflation, almost everything we know is massless, but it tends to become conformally invariant. The fermions become conformally invariant. The photons in D equals 4, they didn't change the dimension, did they? It's still D, 3 plus 1? OK, good. So the photons are conformally invariant. But there are two particles that would have this magic property of m equals 0 and not conformal invariance, at least classically, and would show big effects. And those are massless minimally coupled scalars and gravitons. Okay, and sometimes when I give this talk, I go through a long rendition of how basically every time anybody has ever studied theories which contain one or the other or both of these two particles and looked at enough stuff, sooner or later they see big quantum effects. But I think I'm in a room full of experts, and I don't even need to make that point. So I'll skip that. I'll just say that the way that these things manifest themselves is in what I call infrared logarithms. What are they? They're factors of the logarithm of the de Sitter scale factor, A, which is equal to ht. And they contaminate quantum field theory results, which in flat space are so boring and static. For example, if you looked at the expectation value of the stress tensor in massless minimally coupled lambda phi to the 4 theory, it would have the perfect fluid form, so there'd be a pressure and energy density. I quote a not one but two loop result, very hard to obtain, fully renormalized, by the way, too. For the pressure, it takes this form. It's got a lambda, as you might expect, an h to the fourth, as it has to have on dimensional grounds. And then these guys, these suckers right here, powers of an infrared logarithm squared and an infrared logarithm, and some unimportant 4 pi's and stuff like that. Why do they occur? Well, this one actually is occurring for a very simple reason. It's occurring because of because the biggest contribution at this order is it's a stress tensor, so it's one graviton line in. And it's coming from the expectation value of the phi to the 4 term. And that involves two coincident propagators. And a long, long time ago, as Sasha Dolgoff mentioned to us yesterday, Ford and Vilenkin, Linde and Starobinsky showed that the expectation value, or the coincidence limit, of the scalar propagator consists, of course, of an ultraviolet divergent part, which all propagators have at coincidence, and then plus an infrared logarithm term that grows like log A. And actually, this biggest effect is coming from exactly that, and then everything else is subdominant stuff that just absorbs the ultraviolet divergence and renormalizes it all away. Okay, so that's the first effect, and that occurs in the lowest order. That dominates lowest order things. But if you go to higher order, of course, you're integrating interaction vertices across the past light cone, and that can give rise to effects too, because these propagators tend not to fall off very rapidly. And so if you wind up having an integral of an interaction vertex over some time t prime from 0 to t of something that's going like 1, say, of course, that will integrate up to t. And t can be written as ht divided by h, and ht is just log a. And actually, in higher loop diagrams, this is the dominant effect, but they're both present. Okay? And there's quite a bit of debate about whether infrared logarithms, I think everybody accepts that infrared logarithms are real in certain scalar models. There's quite a bit of debate about whether they're real in models that involve gravity. And I think one thing that's crucially important to notice in that respect is that they've even been seen in the power spectrum, although there is debate about that, too. The first claim of that, I think, is Weinberg's claim. There have been more recent calculations by Giddings and Sloth that I think Martin Sloth will tell us about today. Hebecker and his collaborators told us about a very interesting piece of work previously. And on that same subject, Imrik Kakya and Vakifo Nemli and I have a recent paper out which shows that. And I think this is crucially important to note because this is not only an observable thing, but an observed thing. And it tickles me how some of my math colleagues sometimes make these complicated arguments how you can't observe things that, in fact, are being observed. So I will take the point of view that they're real, although I know some of you bitterly resent that and bitterly object to that. And let me just move on to counting how many occur. And even if you think that they're not real, it is just some stupid gauge artifact that I've deluded myself and that a lot of other people have deluded themselves into believing, you can at least ask, okay, how many would we see in this stupid gauge artifact, right? We can agree that that's an interesting question. And that's easy to answer. And Nick Semis and I came up with the answer after some false starts a while ago. So suppose that you have an interaction, I'll call it delta L, not because it's a counter term, it's just one of the many terms in a Lagrangian, and involves some coupling constant, and then n factors of either massless minimally coupled scalar or gravitons. Remember, those are the two fields that cause these things. And you could have any other fields that you want, photons, fermions, conformally coupled scalars, supermassive particles, or differentiated versions of these guys. Does not matter. All that other stuff, just whatever it is you want. If you want to count how many infrared logarithms this thing is going to give, so now let's imagine we're focusing on some process, and we're asking, okay, suppose we get a correction coming from insertions of this interaction vertex. Okay, how many extra infrared logarithms can we expect with each insertion of that vertex? I'll just give you the rule. The rule is that you can get up to n infrared logarithms, where n is the number of these massless minimally coupled scalars or gravitons that you've got without any derivatives on them, for each factor of the coupling constant squared. And this has been checked explicitly at up to 1 and 2 and even sometimes 3 loop order in some many, many theories. I'll just tell you what it looks like. So for lambda phi to the 4 theory, that result that I told you before tells you that for each extra lambda, you should expect, or for each extra lambda squared, so lambda phi to the 4 has n equals 4, right? So the rule then says that for each extra lambda squared, you should expect up to 4 logarithms. And hence, for each lambda, you should expect 2. And indeed, we saw from the two-loop result for the stress tensor that Vakifo Nemli and I got back in 2002 that that's true. And we've even looked at that at three-loop orders, and the rule continues to be true for that. Scalar quantum electrodynamics involves massless minimally coupled scalars in two ways. So I'm talking about a massless charged scalar, so it's a complex scalar. And you can see that one of the interaction terms, the A phi term, has an undifferentiated scalar there. And then there's also the AA phi star phi term. And this has an e, this has an e squared. So from this one, you'd say n equals 1. And then you'd expect that for each factor of e squared, you'd get one infrared logarithm. Counting is the same from here. This has n equals 2, but the coupling constant there is e squared. So again, you'd expect that. And I want to stress, explicit, detailed, fully dimensionally regulated, fully renormalized calculations in scalar quantum electrodynamics at one and two loop orders show that. We really do see those infrared logarithms. Okay, in Yukawa theory, so we take a massless minimally coupled real scalar field and we Yukawa couple it to a massless fermion, then what would you have? Well, this stuff, the fermions are all in other, just as the A and the differentiated phi are in other. The relevant field is this one, the undifferentiated massless minimally coupled scalar. So n equals 1, hence every g squared should give one factor of an infrared logarithm. And again, explicit, detailed one and even two-loop calculations. So one-loop calculations by myself and Tomislav, two-loop calculations by myself and Shunpei Miao, who isn't here, show that this rule is right. Okay, quantum gravity, how about that? Well, same rules here. So we have the typical interaction vertex for quantum gravity looks like that. So this stuff is all going in other because even though it's gravitons, it's differentiated. So the relevant field is this undifferentiated graviton here. We've got a single factor of kappa, hence we should expect that every time we have a kappa squared, and by the way, kappa is my loop counting parameter, so kappa squared is 16 pi g, where g is Newton's constant. Every time we have a kappa squared, we should expect one infrared logarithm. Kappa is, of course, dimensionful, so it has to go with a dimension, something like a mass squared to be dimensionless. And it turns out in these calculations, it always pairs up with h. So actually, either space or temporally differentiated, but you're jumping ahead to a point that's really interesting, so I'll comment on that a little bit later, but thank you for mentioning that. So, and this has been verified not so well because the only dimensionally regulated, fully dimensionally regulated and renormalized calculations that I know of so far have been done by myself and Shunpei Miao and myself and Emre Kyakya. And they do show that rule, but that's not been so well checked, and that's only checked at one loop order. Okay, so so infrared logarithms are cool, right? I think so anyway. And in a result like this, you know, this is just so much better than the static, boring quantum field theory that I learned at the hands of Sidney Coleman and Steven Weinberg way back an embarrassing number of decades ago. Because now you've got some time dependence going on in this thing. And even if the coupling constant is very, very small, you let inflation run long enough, eventually this time dependence is going to overwhelm that, right? So that brings up the perturbative conundrum. A lot of us who do quantum field theory calculations and really just spend a year calculating a two-loop result, you know, and then our ever-helpful, ever-friendly colleagues go, it's irrelevant, it's going to be small, you shouldn't be doing this, you're idiots and jerks. And the answer, the statement is always the same. The insults are always a little bit different. But the basic comment is you should be doing what I'm doing, which is some fashion stuff or whatever it is. And we always feel bad because it's hard to deal with that, right? I mean, the coupling constants are small. And how can you deal with it? Well, infrared logarithms are a way you can deal with it, right? Sooner or later, they make the result big enough. So it might be interesting. It might be significant. It might be important. But therein lies what I call the perturbative conundrum. And that is that just when it starts to be interesting, just when finally you think, oh, this 2 years that I spent getting this result, it isn't all wasted. Maybe we can actually see something. You encounter the fact that you were just calculating the one or two loop result. And of course, there's higher order corrections to it. And guess what? They all become order one at the same point. So for example, I showed you that in lambda phi to the four theory, each extra lambda gives a logarithm squared. So when the two-loop result that I got with Vakif and becomes significant, the three-loop result is also. So the two-loop result would become significant when log of A is on the order of 1 over square root of lambda, because remember, you get a lambda times log squared. But then the three-loop result has a lambda squared times log A to the fourth, and it's also order 1. And in fact, they're all order 1. What can you conclude from that? Well, you can't conclude that you really got anything big at that stage. All you can conclude legitimately is that perturbation theory broke down. That in itself is an awesome thing, and many times unprecedented in quantum field theory, right? The secular dependence, the secular enhancement and everything. But that's the fair, honest condition. So I'm a particle theorist. My union contract requires me to tell a certain number of lies. But let me just be honest with you about this one. That's the honest conclusion, is that perturbation theory is breaking down. And you can actually estimate when it would break down in scalar quantum electrodynamics, Yukawa, and in gravity. Okay? And so what do you do at that stage? It could be that it adds up to something that's not a very big effect at all. Could be that it is responsible for holding down lambda, for example. Or it could be that it blows up the universe and hence shows you that that's not the right theory that we're in. And I would desperately love to know the answer to do that. And one technique that you might think of to do that is the leading logarithm approximation. So again, a typical result for, say, the expectation value of the stress tensor in lambda phi to the fourth theory gives an energy density, which if I divide out the overall dimensionful factor, looks like this. At two-loop order, you get results that look like that. At three-loop order, you get logs or lambda squared log to the fourth, but you also get a lambda or log to the third and a log squared. And at L-loop order, you get lambda to the L minus 1 times a series that goes like that. This is the leading logarithm term. This is a leading logarithm term. These are subdominant logarithm terms. Perturbation theory breaks down when log of A becomes on the order of 1 over the square root of lambda in this particular theory. At the time that it breaks down, these subdominant ones are still subdominant. It's just when this is barely becoming of order 1, right? One approximation which should be good, certainly as good as long as perturbation theory is valid, and is still valid even when perturbation theory is just breaking down, is to do the leading logarithm approximation, to just forget about all the subdominant junk and take the series of the leading logarithms. Okay, then you've effectively got a result which is looking like lambda times the maximum number of infrared logarithms you could get raised to a simple power. Of course, it's still hell to pay to get those coefficients. Those are very, very difficult to calculate. But it is a little bit of a simplification. And if you could somehow sum this series of leading logarithms, you would have at least one plausible claim to a non-perturbative extension of the model. And now let me just tell you how to do it for these scalar potential models. And that's a set of rules, amazing rules devised by Alexei Starobinsky a long time ago and explained at some detail in this paper with Junichi Yokoyama. And I'll explain the rules in the context of lambda phi to the fourth theory, although they work for any scalar potential model. So what you do is you take the exact operator field equations, which for lambda phi to the fourth theory look like that, and you simplify them. You simplify them in two ways. You throw away the second derivative term, so you just throw away that term, you throw away that term, but you keep the potential term. And further, in this first derivative term, the Hubble friction term, everywhere where you have a phi dot, you subtract from it a stochastic jitter term. What is the stochastic jitter term? I'm, by the way, just giving you the rules. And if they sound ad hoc and unmotivated, they are at this stage, although I'll prove them to be true. I think Starobinsky is near genius level to have guessed this. So here are just the rules, and then I'll show you why they're true, okay? So what is the stochastic jitter? The stochastic jitter is just the free field mode sum of the scalar field, where this is the free creation and annihilation operators, but with the mode function stochastically truncated. So you take the full U of T and K, and you just take the limit that pertains when k in the long wavelength limit, which is that this is just h over the square root of 2k to the third. Okay, and you cut it off, or you put a delta function there so that you're just including the things which happen to be experiencing horizon crossing at the instant time, at the instant t. Okay, so this is a delta function enforcing k is equal to h a of t. Okay, and no matter how weird that might seem to you, those set of rules might seem to you, I assert to you without proof, although I'll give you the proof in a minute, that those do reproduce exactly the leading infrared logarithms at each order in perturbation theory all the way up. Further, they actually give you a way to sum up the series of leading logarithms. Okay, and how does it work? Well, even though we might think this is really weird as quantum field theorists, a statistical mechanics guy who was looking at that would say, oh boy, that's an equation I recognize. That's a Langevin equation. We should think of this scalar field. I don't know what you quantum field theorists are talking about with quantum field operators and all that nonsense and rubbish. This is a stochastic random variable that's driven by this stochastic noise source F there. And I know how to solve that. If you're interested in, this stochastic noise source obeys what's called Gaussian white noise. It's the T minus T prime that tells you that it's white noise. It obeys something called a Fokker-Planck equation. So if you're looking at the, if what you want to know is the expectation value of some function, could be any function of the field of T and X, then what you do is you look for a probability distribution that they'll tell you how to solve, rho of t and phi, and then you do a number over a C number, an integral, over a C number variable phi, just minus infinity to infinity, of the same function f of phi, and that will recapture exactly what this thing is. And what is the equation that rho obeys? Well, it obeys this Fokker-Planck equation that rho dot is equal to a second derivative term whose coefficients you can read off from the variance of the Gaussian term of the white noise correlator, and a linear term that you can read off from the potential piece. Okay, so in general, this would be the V prime times rho, and in general, this would be whatever that number is right there. And this thing, I just tell you, reproduces the leading infrared logarithms to all orders in perturbation theory. And if that shocks you, it shocked me, it amazed me that that was true. I remember when Starobinsky told me that, I thought, oh, that just can't be true. And he smiled sort of confidently, knowingly, and challenged me to check it. And I thought, oh, he's surely wrong. I had some unpublished three-loop results that I thought I would surely be able to catch him. But no, it turned out it does agree right down the line. When it was agreeing at three loops, I was pretty sure it was right. I still didn't know why it was right. I'll show you why it's right. Okay? And what questions ought you to ask as quantum field theorists at this stage? You ought to be saying, whoa! Even if it's working, how can it possibly be working? I mean, it started out being a quantum field theory. Last time I checked, unless they changed something, those things had divergences. They obeyed the uncertainty principle. This is a stochastic random variable. No divergences. No uncertainty principle. It's a stochastic field. It commutes with itself. How can this possibly be true? Okay, so I'll show you that. But first, I'll answer Nyesha's question, or try to anyway. Yes, non-dynamical gravity. And I don't know how to deal with gravity yet. Hubble's a constant. Okay, so so the proof Nick Tsamis and I worked out way back in 2005, and it works the same way that you start with Starobinsky's rules. So you take the exact field equation. Yes, Chris. That's right, only on the leading logarithms. No. No one knows that. That's an open problem. So you start with the exact field equations, and you do something which an old fogey like myself could recognize as a Yang-Feldman equation. Yes, sure. News to me, but great news if possible. Or great news. Okay, so what you do is you integrate this field equation, right? So this is a second-order differential operator. You just act that inverse differential operator on the field equation, and what you get, of course, is the field, and then the inverse differential operator acting on the potential term. I've indicated that by the integral of a Green's function acting on that the derivative of the potential term. And then, of course, also, you have to take account of the fact that the linear differential operator has zero mode, so you have to add in a free solution. Okay? And the people who are very, very, very old in this audience, such as myself, might recognize that as the Yang-Feldman equation. It's a way to generate the interaction picture of quantum field theory. This thing is just a free field expansion of the exact mode, the exact free field mode functions of the linearized creation and annihilation operators. And if you just iterated that order by order in perturbation theory, you would generate the interaction picture starting at wherever you chose to turn on the interaction. And these are the exact mode functions for de Sitter. And it's important to note that the retarded Green's function can be written as a commutator of these mode functions. Okay? So far I've made no approximation. This is just an exact rewriting of the theory in a way that's convenient for perturbation theory. Okay? I'm sorry?
At which stage it might have strong interactions, this procedure will fail. So, like, here.
I don't think it'll ever fail. But if you didn't do perturbation theory, if somehow there was no perturbative result, then I don't have any proof.
So you're assuming you have Gaussian white noise, essentially, right? So at some level, there would be more terms than that.
Well, that turns out I'll derive where the Gaussian white noise comes from. So I'll derive it comes from doing something to this. So that's not going to be approximated at all. That's no approximation in that. That's right. Okay, so let me generate that free field expansion, and let me do it the way one of my American colleagues who doesn't know high school algebra would do it and doesn't understand complicated notions like the fact that if you take an integral over a function of time, you have to put the function of time to the right of the integration sign and not to the left of the integration sign. And some of you foreigners are laughing.
It's just a matter of convention.
Yes. Well, in doing the integrals, you do get a different result for integral dt t than for t times integral 1. Those things are different, but not in the United States anymore, and it hurts the self-esteem of our students to notice that difference. So I'll make use of some math identities. Whenever you ask a equation or ask for a proof in America these days, you get all kinds of interesting theorems, and I'll take use of some of those theorems that my students have acquainted me with to do this analysis, because actually at the level that I'm interested in, I don't need to worry about that. So we'll take the basic Yang-Feldman equation, which looks like this. It's phi is equal to phi zero plus interaction vertex being integrated up against phi to the third, and then we'll just iterate that, right, to generate the interaction pitcher expansion. And of course, we get something that looks like that. And all of you know that I have to be, in reality, I have to be careful about which order I do the integrals in, right? So these phi to the thirds are not always at the same time as there, and these are not all at the same time, and I have to say that. But let's just look at it the way an American undergraduate would look at it, just counting the number of interaction vertices and the number of phi to the thirds, because that's all we, in fact, need to get. Okay, so now I'll do something else that my American students would do. I'll factor a single v naught out. Of course, this is garbage, right? I can't pull it through the integrals and everything, but I'll do it anyway, because I'm just interested in counting the number of phi naughts that there are at each order in lambda. So I get a series that looks like this, right? So it starts off, phi is, unsurprisingly, one phi naught, and then each extra lambda has one interaction vertex and two free fields. And next order, that thing squared, et cetera. Okay? So what that means is that if I was looking at any expectation value, like phi to the n, I would have phi naught to the n plus, again, this. And I'm not even going to worry about the n that would be sitting there. That's all irrelevant for my purposes. Okay, so I get some series that looks like that. If I just take this thing and, doing it right, of course, and plugged it into the expectation value of phi to the n, and then evaluated all the free field fields, I would get the perturbative expansion for that VEV, right? Okay, well, where do infrared logarithms come from? Turns out that as we've noticed here, each extra lambda brings an extra vertex integration somewhere along the line, and an extra two free fields somewhere along the line, right? And we also noticed from the rules that I told you have been checked and counted a lot that we get up to two extra infrared logarithms for each extra lambda in this particular theory. Where do they come from? Well, it turns out one of them comes from the interaction of V. That's that second source that I told you about when you have an interaction vertex and you just are doing an integral that looks like this. And you also can get one from the VEVs of these propagators from the first thing, the old thing that Linde and Starobinsky and Ford and Vilenkin found. And further, that's the only place that you can get them. And you know that the maximum number you can get is 2. So you know a very, very important thing, and that is that if you're going to be at leading logarithm order, that is, if for each extra lambda you're going to have exactly two infrared logarithms and no fewer, it has to be that each of these things produces that infrared logarithm. There's no way out of it. That allows you to do an amazing thing. That allows you to infrared truncate those free fields and the Green's functions. So the full mode function is that complicated thing. But we can just do the long wavelength expansion, because it's not very many terms in the long wavelength expansion that's responsible for the infrared logarithm. So here's the long wavelength expansion of that guy. And the infrared logarithm in the VEV of the propagator is coming from just this term. The infrared logarithm in that vertex is coming from this term right here. So infrared logarithms from phi naught require only this term. If you just took phi naught, those phi naughts, and replaced them by the infrared truncated version, this, with the wave functions simplified to just that, you would not change the leading order infrared logarithm pieces at all. You'd totally change the theory. You'd completely butcher it. You'd throw away a lot of stuff about the uncertainty principle, change the ultraviolet behavior, totally butcher it. But if you're myopically focused on just getting the leading infrared logarithms, doing this to the free fields would not make any change at all. Right? Further, you could change the Green's function too. Because remember, each vertex integration has to give an infrared logarithm in order to reach leading infrared logarithm order. If even one doesn't, then you've already lost it. You're subdominant. So if you're just focusing on the leading infrared logarithms, every single vertex has to. And that means you can simplify these things too. Since this is a commutator, you have to expand out to take the first non-zero imaginary piece. That means this order. So you get one of these times that and the other way around. Get a term that looks like that. And so you can simplify the Green's function to this. Because when you just keep this, the k to the third from that cancels this k to the third from there, and I can do the integral. It's a delta function. And further, it turns out you can even drop, this term right here, because the whole thing will get multiplied by a measure factor. So it'll be multiplied by an a to the third, an a prime to the third. And if you're doing an integral and you want to produce an infrared logarithm like this, you will get one from here. So there's two kinds of terms, a to the third times 1 over a minus 1 over a prime to the third. This one won't. See, it'll be dominated by the growth of that exponential. This one will. So you can even drop that term and just simplify the retarded Green's function to just have that piece. You do all of those things, and then very, very important, crucial point, you can do it to the fields in the Yang-Feldman equation. Again, why? Because it has to be true for every single free field, for every single vertex, in order to reach leading logarithm approximation. That's the thing that tells you you don't have to generate the full expansion. You can do it in the field equation. Okay? So I'll do it in the field equation. I'll infrared truncate the full Yang-Feldman field equation, which looks like this, and again, just reproduces everything in the theory. I'll infrared truncate it to this, where this guy is just the free field expansion with that infrared truncation done on it, and this is the result of taking that infrared truncation of the vertex. Now, this thing, even though it's totally different from the original theory, has different ultraviolet behavior, completely different mode expansion, will exactly reproduce the leading infrared logarithms, not just at one loop order or two, to all orders. Everything else is different, but the leading infrared logarithms are the same. Now, to get Starobinsky's equation, I just do an awesomely complicated thing. I take a time derivative. If I take the time derivative, I've now got phi dot minus phi zero dot, and guess what? Phi zero dot is just exactly the stochastic source that you asked about. That's where it all came from. That's the derivation of Starobinsky's result. Starobinsky's result is so neat because not only can you check it order by order in perturbation theory, you can also, and it agrees, again, order by order in perturbation theory, as high up as it's ever been checked, it agrees. You also can non-perturbatively resum it. And the way that goes is by using the Yang or the Fokker-Planck equation. So it's the physics of competition. In this lambda phi to the four theory, we've got a potential that's looking like this, right? V is a function of phi. roughly speaking, what's happened is that inflationary particle production is pushing the scalar up its potential. You can see that that's a losing game, right? Because even when it gets pushed up the potential, the inflationary particle production doesn't get any stronger over here. In fact, it gets a little bit weaker as it goes up higher on its potential because the thing tends to develop curvature, which suppresses the effect. And the classical force grows like phi to the third. So you have a thing pushing this way, which never grows, and something pushing back that way, which grows like phi to the third. Sooner or later, they have to come into equilibrium, right? So you could guess just from the physics of competition that this is going to reach an equilibrium state. Suppose we just make that as our ansatz. Then the Fokker-Planck equation, which was rho dot is equal to all of this stuff, just becomes zero is equal to all of this stuff. Then it's not a complicated second-order differential equation. It's a first-order differential equation because I can forget about one of the d by d phis. And even I, a superannuated hack physics professor, can solve that first-order differential equation. But I didn't have to because Starobinsky and Yokoyama solved it a long time ago. The result for the late-time probability distribution is this. And then you can evaluate the VEV of anything, like phi to the 2n. There's the exact result for what phi to the 2n asymptotes to at late times. Is this not awesome? I mean, you can count on one hand the number of genuinely non-perturbative results you can get in quantum field theory, and this has to be one of them. This is awesome. Sure. It came from taking, so mathematically it came from going from here, the thing that was the integrated Yang-Feldman version, and then just deriving Starobinsky's equation by taking the time derivative. So the time derivative could hit the only time dependence is right here. So it, when it hits there, that's where I get the delta function. Or it comes from the infrared truncation of the fields. That is, the reason they call these infrared logarithms is because it's only the infrared that contributes to them. Okay, so like I say, this is awesome that you can do this, and I think just an act of genius by Starobinsky, frankly. But it's a little bit incomplete. It's wonderful, but it's not quite enough for us because it works for all scalar potential models, that is, massless minimally coupled scalar plus arbitrary potential, but we have more general theories that we're interested in, right? So, for example, quantum electrodynamics, I told you, shows infrared logarithms. It's not of that form. Yukawa theory shows them. Quantum gravity shows them. It's not of that form. Gravity plus Dirac shows them, right? So more general theories have two kinds of complications. They have the active fields, which cause infrared logarithms, like phi and h transverse traceless. And then they have these passive fields, like the a in scalar quantum electrodynamics, or the psi in Yukawa theory. Those things don't cause infrared logarithms. And we actually do know how to deal with that complication. We don't yet know how to deal with the additional complication of derivatives. So let me just briefly tell you about that. So passive fields, these are the ones like vector potentials, fermions that don't cause infrared logarithms that are present in the more general theory. First off, you might think, okay, if they don't cause infrared logarithms, who cares about them? Let's just ignore them. Well, first, that would be a violation of multiculturalism and diversity, which you never can do in the United States. But second, it's wrong physically. And although they don't create infrared logarithms, they can carry them from one point to another. So, for example, VEV of F mu nu shows infrared logarithms. Second, they can mediate new interactions between active fields, and those things are important. You have to take into account. There's a big complication of the passive fields because although I showed you, I hope explicitly, that you could just infrared truncate the active fields, and you only need to get their infrared part right in order to reproduce all the leading infrared logarithms, you can't do that for the passives. They contribute things like constants, essentially, no infrared logarithms, or maybe order one functions of space and time. Those things, those functions that they contribute, come as much from the ultraviolet as from the infrared. So you cannot do this awesome simplification where you just infrared truncate them in the effective field equations. You can't do that. That's an error. Okay, so what do you do? Well, what you do may sound kind of stupid at first, but it's right. What you do is just integrate out the passive fields. And that, of course, gives you a complicated effective action, which is non-local and hopeless to deal with. But then you've got it all in terms of active fields, right? And the only non-locality is through passive differential operators, which themselves cannot produce infrared logarithms by vertex operations. So it turns out at that stage, then you can just infrared truncate everything. And that gives you, and you can assume effectively that the fields are constant, that the active fields are constant. And that gives you something that we're all used to doing that we can calculate explicitly, AKA the effective potential, right? And a lot of explicit results have been obtained on that, both in scalar quantum electrodynamics and Yukawa theory. I'll tell you about the scalar quantum electrodynamic ones that Tomislav and Nick and I have obtained. So perturbative results occur at one-loop order. The one-loop vacuum polarization has been done and used to correct the photon wave functions, although not yet the force. That's ongoing right now. The one-loop scalar self-mass squared has been calculated and used to correct the scalar mode functions. Much more difficult and involved two-loop calculations have been done for the scalar field strength, for the scalar bilinears, and for F mu nu, and also for the VEV of the stress tensor. And those all agree exactly with the predictions that you get. And of course, the neat thing about Starobinsky's formalism is that you can get non-perturbative results from it too, the late time results, after you push yourselves up this effective potential. Here they are, the maximum scalar field strength asymptotes out here. The photon develops a mass, but it asymptotes out to a constant. The scalar still stays perturbatively light. And the vacuum energy goes a little bit negative, actually. OK, so let me just very briefly comment now about derivative interactions. So that's the problem, that the one complication that we can deal with, passive fields, The problem that we can't deal with yet is derivatives. We don't know how to deal with, and I'm hoping that some people at this conference will be able to help deal with them, or maybe come up with a completely different way. I don't know. So a priori, they're similar to passive fields. So for example, suppose we're dealing with gravity, and we write it out as an expansion in graviton fields. It's got two derivatives distributed variously on the graviton fields, and then but a bunch of undifferentiated gravitons as well. Thank you. The differentiated gravitons cannot give infrared logarithms. But the undifferentiated ones, and they're all over there, can and do. The just like passive fields, so this is very much like passive fields. These guys are just like the passive fields, like the A field, the psi bar psi. Those things, remember, aren't zero. You can't just throw them away. They do stuff. But what they do is no infrared logarithms. What they do is like constants. And so you have to treat these things exactly and include the infrared and ultraviolet effect in it. But these guys, you could, in principle, infrared truncate. However, now you've got a complication that we didn't have in the passives. In the passives, this was a different field than those things. And hence, I could just integrate these guys out. How do I do that when it's the same field? Or equivalently, if I look at it in the Yang-Feldman formalism and I do the free field expansion, when I generate an expansion of these H's and those H's too in free fields, some of the free fields in that expansion of this thing, only two of them can wind up having those two derivatives. And in the expansion of this thing, only one of them can wind up having the derivatives. Which one is it? Well, of course, it's all of them, right? And so you can't anymore identify one particular thing that gets it and then just infrared truncate that and simplify the field equations. That's the thing that has so far frustrated extending this to derivative interactions. And I wish to God I knew how to do it. I don't. Let me just tell you, to leave you with two pieces of information about that. So every time somebody does an explicit result on this, it's like data that you can use to understand something. So first, I want to emphasize the importance of spin versus kinetic energy. And that's a contradistinction between two results of recent graduate students, Emery Kyahya and Shunpei Miao. So Emery Kyahya was looking at quantum gravity plus massless minimally coupled scalar. He computed the infrared logarithms, if there were any, on scalar mode functions at one loop order and found there aren't any in those papers. Shunpei Miao's thesis was to do the same thing for fermions, and she found that there is one at one loop order. And she actually went back later on in this paper and went through a diagram by diagram difference calculation of it to show where it comes from. And where it comes from is the spin term. It's the spin interaction, the spin potential that's doing it, that's giving rise to the reason that she got a result here and he didn't. What it seems to be going on is that the gravitons do want to give an infrared logarithm, but they're coupled to the kinetic energy term, which is redshifting for the scalar, like 1 over a squared, and it's just that's just killing the effect. But the spin-spin effect is surviving even to late times, because even if you redshift something, it still has spin too, right? So that's the first admonition. And the second and final one, and I'll stop after this, is from a recent paper that Emre Kyahya and Vakifa Nemli and I wrote on looking now not at pure de Sitter, but scalar-driven inflation. And I just want to leave you with some admonitions. First off, if you're looking for infrared logarithms, it's not legitimate to drop off slow roll suppressed interactions. Why not? Because the propagator goes like 1 over epsilon. You can already see that from the power spectrum. That's why we can see the scalar amplitude and not the tensor one. And that means that if you have more propagators and vertices, which you do at one-loop diagrams, then you're not epsilon suppressed. You're actually epsilon enhanced. So it's just you make an error if you do that. Second, it's crucial what lines get the derivatives. For example, if you look at a theory with scalar, with spectator scalar sigma and then the zeta field, this thing at one loop order will not produce an infrared logarithm. This diagram, which looks almost identical to that one, does. The reason why is because the derivatives can be distributed differently, right? In this kind of a diagram, you can get a piece where the derivatives act there and the derivatives act there. It's that one which is doing it. Second or third, I think that sometimes people are implicitly doing approximations without maybe knowing it by appealing to the delta n formalism, and I'd like to just caution against that. And finally, just a general comment, it's a losing game, of course, to look for infrared logarithms in the scalar power spectrum, right? You're down by one loop order, which is a huge suppression. You might get an enhancement of 60. That's an enormous enhancement. Yes. Right. It's because, so suppose we're contrasting zeta, d sigma versus zeta, d zeta. And we're looking at zeta lines coming in and zeta lines going out, right, because it's a zeta-zeta correlator. Well, this one, the only way you can have it happen is to have this thing be sigma, right? The outgoing vertex has to connect up with zeta. Here, the outgoing vertex could connect up to any one of these three zetas, including the differentiated one. And so you can get the derivatives to be sitting like that. This interaction, this topology, never does it. This one does. So that's the reason. I'll be happy to go over that more in more detail with you later, but I probably should finish because I'm a little bit over time here. Finally, I would just like to impress upon you the folly of looking for infrared logarithms in the scalar power spectrum. I think they are there. It's important to notice that because it does establish they're there in an observable quantity, and that's important because people question that. But it's just a losing game. The loop suppression is so enormous that even if you get a factor of 60 enhancement, it's not going to do much, right? It's still going to be very, very hard to ever observe that. But let's look at the reason why this is not going to overwhelm that. It's because you're only getting the infrared logarithms to begin building up at horizon crossing when the thing stops oscillating and starts freezing in, right? And that already suggests what you really should be looking at, and that is things which are not observable as spatially varying right now. See, it was demanding that we be looking at a mode that's spatially varying right now that put us in that conundrum that we can't get this ever big enough to overwhelm that. But if we looked at something that's constant, then it could have been, or effectively constant, it could have been getting infrared logarithm contributions from back from the beginning of inflation, right? And who knows when inflation began? It could have been very, very, very far in the future. And constants are observable, too. In fact, a lot of the more interesting questions are about constants, like what is lambda, what is g, stuff like that. So I'd like to just, if we could, maybe remove focus from the power spectrum, which I think is just a losing game as far as infrared logarithms, to the stuff where we might see really, really big effects, and we might be able to beat this conundrum. Okay, thanks very much. I'm sorry for going over time.
the competition between the stochastic force.
Yeah, and let me the draw it more force. Carefully for Robert.
So, this, so you are considering fixed H.
Yes, I'm considering fixed H.
Now, if you try to naively include, if you have V of phi generating H, then you actually find that the stochastic driving term becomes larger the larger phi is. And that's basically stochastic inflation.
So could you say that one more time again, please?
Right, so if you take into account the fact that H
yes.
square is going to be proportional to...
Right, so if you're dealing with scalar-driven inflation and as the field evolves, H changes. Yes, you're right. There's a very interesting effect that goes on there. And that's also something that I should have listed as something that I don't know how to deal with yet. So the Starobinsky method can be proven to work for de Sitter. Plausibly, it works for things which are close to de Sitter. But again, no proof about that. But in the situation where H is changing a lot as the scalar evolves, I don't think anybody knows for sure what's going on there.
When
if they do, I don't.
See, when Slava Mukhanov, Raul Abramo, and myself started working on back reaction, we were actually trying to show that this stochastic picture was wrong.
Uh-huh.
That the back reaction terms were more important. So now, if Starobinsky's method would apply, then this would actually be in support of stochastic inflation.
Yeah, but I don't look at stochastic effects as being in contradistinction to back reaction. I look at them as a way of encapsulating the most important back reaction effects. But you're absolutely right that there is an effect going on there about the inflationary particle production is sort of pushing you up, and that's pushing you up by something that depends upon what H is. And as phi changes, then H changes too. And that's got an interesting time dependence that I don't know how to resolve. Yes?
We wrote a paper about this quantum retirement effective potential. So there we do know the result.
We know some infrared logarithm results. We don't, I think, know how to resum.
Well, we just know the long loop result.
That's right. So lots of very interesting work has been done by Tomislav and by other people in this audience. And forgive me for not mentioning it. I didn't mean to shortchange anybody of credit. About infrared logarithms and secular dependence in non-de Sitter results. The thing that I can prove works is Starobinsky's technique at all orders in the Sitter background for scalar potential models. So I wanted to limit myself to what I could actually prove to all orders in perturbation theory, although I did not mean at all that there aren't other interesting effects in time-dependent backgrounds. Yes, Dan?
Yeah, these products of operators here, phi squared, etc., they need regularization. And yesterday, Sasha told us that some ways of regularizing the phi square operator gave the wrong sign.
Right.
And
so I
all
think
of this picture is based on this positive sign because you have this Brownian type description.
Well, I think it was just one of these sort of word things that you might sort of make sense if you said it in words, but when you look at what you're actually doing, it doesn't. So, for example, take this diagram right here. Right? Could we agree that the way we should renormalize phi to the fourth theory is in the context of phi to the fourth theory, right? And that what goes on with the free scalar stress tensor doesn't a priori have anything to do with phi to the fourth theory. Could we accept that? So I would say that in this diagram, where this coincident propagator I delta of x and x does have an ultraviolet divergent part, and then the infrared logarithm that's showing the effect. I would say that the way you remove that ultraviolet divergence is not by regarding this as a piece of a free scalar field theory and then renormalizing the scalar stress tensor. That's not what you do. What you do instead is you add a counterterm that looks like this. So there's two counterterms that renormalize the divergences in this diagram. There's a conformal counterterm that looks like that, which renormalizes one of them. And there's also a cosmological counterterm that looks like that. And those are the things that actually renormalize that diagram, not the renormalization that you would have gotten if you had renormalized the the free stress tensor, this thing piece by piece. So see, I think that's what's the resolution of Sasha's paradox. And that's sort of in the nicest of both worlds, right? It means that Sasha's right, and all of the rest of us who did this later on and got the same minus sign are right. But Starobinsky is also right. The infrared logarithm really is there. And it just has to do with where you would, which theory you're renormalizing. If you're renormalizing a free scalar field theory, then you do one thing. If you're renormalizing a lambda phi to the 4 theory, then you do another thing, and that turns out just not to be the same thing as renormalizing this diagram in free scalar field theory. Does that make sense?
Well, what you're saying is that the renormalization of the energy momentum tensor is different from the renormalization that the composite operator phi squared would have.
See, I actually don't even think of it as a composite operator. I think of it as a 1PI, a one graviton function. So I would say it just gets renormalized by primitive renormalization with the addition of the cosmological counterterm. And that's a little bit more powerful way of thinking about it, I think, because then you don't have to do any composite operator renormalization.
We're already running late, so I think it's more questions. So I went up there.
Yes. Probably you're going to say the same thing. I think both Steve Giddings and Martin Schloss, and according to what I also said in my talk, it's simplifying that gravitons do contribute the leading logarithms to the power spectrum.
I agree.
That's okay, good.
I don't disagree. I agree passionately.
But the other point is that this is a question, just a simple question.
I mentioned you all, too.
Yeah, I know. Well, I'm confused. You're completely overestimating my ego.
Does that answer your question?
No, the question was on the very last line of your talk. you say that you shouldn't look at the power spectrum, but rather at constant, and I don't see.
I think it's a losing game.
I don't see that there's any kind of clear point that these constants are subject to these corrections. That is my worry.
What? You don't think that the vacuum energy receives contributions from the infrared as well as the ultraviolet?
It's not obvious to me, because the vacuum energy...
Oh, first off, look, as an American, I can't tolerate this. This is a violation of multiculturalism and diversity. You're discriminating against infrared gravitons. I think you need to take some sensitivity training to... Well, so seriously, come on.
It's a local operator. It's a local quantity.
But if we look at we can write out the momentum integrations, right? They're integrals d3k. At one loop order, we could just write down what's doing it, right? It's an integral d3k. Why do you say that this thing should be cut off at ultraviolet, that I should only include ultraviolet terms?
Because the expansion of the universe is something that happens due to dynamics locally inside one scissor patch, one Hubble size patch.
Okay, I agree.
And from the perspective of this patch, all these modes that have left the horizon are just background, classical background, in fact.
So what? I agree. So
which
what?
Not affect the dynamics.
What? Whoa. Do you think you seem to be arguing that a constant does not affect expansion? I submit to you, this guy is affecting our expansion.
A constant tensor mode, for example. A constant tensor mode.
How about the product of two? How about the product of two constant tensor modes? Like, for example, this.
Well, the derivatives are irrelevant because we're talking about soft guys, right?
Okay, how about h squared times that? This would give rise to some constant. This would give rise to an infrared logarithm, and it'd be spatially constant. How about that?
Yes, I'm happy with that. But the point is that the test is actually gauge away from...
How? Show me. Prove that to me. Whoa. Prove. So there's an important theorem here, and that is epsilon is not equal to zero, right? So you're right that infrared stuff is small. That's absolutely right. Completely correct. But small is not the same thing as zero. And so they do have some effect, and then we just argue about how much. And what could happen is that the large number of them could overwhelm the intrinsic smallness of them. And of course, it's easy to see that that's likely to happen.
Would you agree that a large number of soft guys sums up from their local perspective to a constant background?
To a spatial constant, yes.
Spatially constant background.
Sure, of course. Not even sums up, it's spatially constant.
Sure. But this spatial
each one of them, mode by mode, looks spatially constant.
The spatially constant background of the scalar field, for example, is simply a shift in the position along the inverton trajectory. That you probably would agree with.
So what? Yes. Okay.
And I think the same is true for, or at least it's conceivable that the same is true for the graviton, because we are just talking about the
suppose the potential doesn't reach zero. Whoa, suppose the potential doesn't reach zero and the shift carries you to lower vacuum energy. Which it could do. I gave you an example in scalar quantum electrodynamics how the vacuum energy gets lower.
It's a question of whether the correction to H as a classical field.
See, what you're arguing is to say, look, any change that you make in the vacuum energy could be just regarded as moving the scalar a little bit further on that way or a little bit further on that way.
Precisely.
Suppose that the change actually lowers the vacuum energy from there to here. There's no change in the scalar field that will move you a little bit further along. There's no way to move along this classical potential.
My intuition may be wrong, but my intuition is that the effect comes exclusively and can be seen as moving the scalar and not as shifting.
No,
false.
Can I make,
no, false.
Can I make
false.
A comment?
You, if you can actually change the shape. You can change the shape.
I think we have to limit to questions that are relevant to the talk and have this discussion afterwards. So, Steve, I was going to recognize you next.
Well, I just had it wasn't this question. It's just a comment. If we feel that the name of the game is to compute the wave function of the universe at all times, say, then Starobinsky's methods may be great for giving certain approximations to that, but if we truly have a breakdown of perturbation theory that can't be exactly resummed, then that's a pretty profound statement. It tells us that we need some better non-perturbative approach to calculating.
I'm open to suggestions.
Well, I don't know. I don't have suggestions, but the point is that the Starobinsky approach is at best only going to give us an approximation to that.
It'll give us the leading log resummation, right?
Okay, yeah, but that's only going to give an approximation to the actual question of the universe, if that's what you
But mean. I'd pay money to have that.
I
know.
Sure.
I'd love
it's
to have that.
Information, but it's not complete information.
Little steps for little feet, right? I'd like to know that one first, and then maybe we could talk about leading log or sub-leading logarithm corrections, or even maybe leading log is just a red herring. Maybe there's some better approximation technique. But yes, what you're saying is we need a non-perturbative way of going, and I agree with you absolutely.
I think there's a lot of discussion. I have questions, but we're going to have to make this the very last thing, Robert.
I'd just like to have a comment to Arthur. So your intuition is exactly right for one-loop scalar modes, scalar gravitational modes, if you have only adiabatic perturbations. That's shown in Ghazal's thesis. In that case, if you introduce entropy modes, then you do have an effect on the background. So it's again shown that in Ghazal's efficiency analysis. Maybe you should raise your hand, Ghazal.
This is again a background for the other field, for the non-curvature perturbation. Isn't that true?
No, it's something that actually relaxes the background, like Richard's.
So below the limit of available capacity.
Yeah.
I see. Okay. That is fine.
Okay. I think this is an interesting discussion. I have some questions, but I think we should stop here, have our coffee break, and be back in 15 minutes, 20 max. Thank you.